This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. Our interventions and the risks and sacrifices they entail are justified only if they serve the larger aims of a person's life. Those are the words of surgeon Atul Gawande in his new book called Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. Atul Gawande is a staff writer for The New Yorker, a professor at the Harvard Medical School, and a MacArthur Fellow. Welcome to The Record.
Thanks for having me.
You write that at the end of life, all too often, medical interventions do not serve those larger aims of a person's life. What do you mean by that? Maybe you could give an example.
Well, you know, we've reached a point where, by the end of the 1990s, more than 80% of us will die in institutions. In those places, what struck me as a surgeon trying to figure out how I should handle these situations is I often knew people were coming to their ends that and yet we never managed to acknowledge it. And then I would take them to surgery and, we'd be hoping they'd win the lottery ticket and this would all go great. But they would come out never waking up again. They would be in the ICU for a week or two and then die there. And it was clear that that was causing suffering and pain for them because they'd never gotten the chance to meet any priorities they had for what they might, if you have a short time left, what would you want to do with that time? No chance to say goodbye, I love you, I'm sorry, any of those kinds of things. And then it was devastating for the families.
Kind of an operative term there, the lottery ticket, because when you're facing something serious like death, you sort of have, I buy lottery tickets.
Yeah.
I know I'm probably not going to win, but I'll buy a lottery ticket. And when it comes to your own life, you'd probably buy a lottery ticket and take a chancy, a risky operation, right?
And if it was a buck and that was all it was going to cost you, you'd be like, yeah, I want that lottery ticket. But the costs are pretty severe. There's a really, I think, fascinating trial that reflects many trials now that have been done. This was one at the Mass General Hospital with stage 4 lung cancer patients. This is not ultimately curable when it's at stage 4. The average survival is 11 months. They had half of the patients get usual oncology care, and the other half got usual oncology care, but also a palliative care physician who saw them to discuss, hard topics, what your goals might be if the care didn't solve the problems. The group who had those discussions, number one, they stopped chemotherapy sooner. They had a third fewer days in the hospital, less likely to die in the ICU, much more likely to die at home. They started hospice sooner and more often. And the kicker is that this group ended up living 25% longer. So the lottery ticket that you described, when you give that fourth round of chemotherapy in the hope that it might win you that lottery ticket, it is more often than not causing you tremendous toxicity and actually harming your chances for the future. It's our inability to recognize that people have priorities besides just living longer.
What you write about here is a lot of what you as a physician deal with, what medical professionals deal with. We've kind of gone away from the model of doctor knows best to what you describe as more of a consumer model. You could take the blue pill or the red pill. It's kind of up to you. And you say that both don't really work, particularly in end-of-life situations.
Yeah, it's this interesting evolution over the last 50 years. I think we really rejected the idea that the doctor would not even tell you what the options really were, just this is what you're going to get and that's it. We rejected it in the 80s and in the 90s. And my medical training in medical school, it was really around this idea that, yeah, I do call it the retail model. Do you want the red shoes or the blue shoes? And here are the options and here are the choices and the risks and the benefits and the pros and the cons. Now, what do you want to do? And I was literally told to say, if the person says, well, what would you do, doctor? To really say, this is not my decision. This is your decision to make. But what people want over time, and I found this from just, I interviewed more than 200 patients and families about their experiences. I followed geriatricians around, palliative care doctors and nursing home aides. And what people want is some guidance because this is the only time they have to die. And you have people who've had a lot of experience understanding what's there. And our great difficulty is you need to know what their priorities are in order to provide some advice. The most effective way to know what people's priorities are is to ask. And we don't. We haven't even had the words to begin to. I didn't feel I had the words to know how to ask what were your priorities if you can't just live longer.
So how would a conversation like that go?
What I found was that in really following a lot of different kinds of doctors and nurses, that some of them were really effective in these situations in ways that I wasn't. And one of the things that they taught me, number one, was in these conversations that the doctor should be talking less than 50% of the time. And I looked at my own practice when talking to patients about decisions like, should we do this operation or not? I was talking 90% of the time. I was just supplying the data and then saying, okay, now what do you want? And the key questions that people were really good at it asked were, first of all, so what is your understanding of your condition, your health at this point in time? What are your fears and worries for the future? What are your goals if your health worsens? And what are the outcomes that you would consider unacceptable? And from that, people are describing you to the boundaries of their decision, what they really care about. And you can then actually say, well, there is option A, there's option B and option C. And this one is going to, you know, these two are going to actually hurt your priorities and objectives. Option C might be the way we want to go here.
And the priorities get very real. I mean, I want to be able to watch a football game and eat something. I want to be able to visit with family when you force them to consider what is important to them at the very end.
Yeah, I had this conversation with my father, who was a surgeon. He now has died 3 years ago. And when he was diagnosed, I was writing about this for The New Yorker and ended up using these questions. And when I asked him these questions, the conversation became, I said, you know, one of my colleagues, his father said, if I could watch football on television and eat chocolate ice cream, that would be good enough for me. And my dad said, absolutely no way that's good enough for me. He was a surgeon, so a little bit of a control freak, and loved social interaction. And he wanted to know that he could be socially active and that he could still make some contribution in the world. And that meant drawing the lines around, you know, if his brain wasn't working or if he's in such pain that he can't participate in any way, if he can't have, you know, a dinner party, that for him was, you know, what was life worth living for if I couldn't do those things? And so those became, as we had to walk our way through decisions about surgery and then radiation therapy, and then when that wasn't working, chemotherapy, whether he'd go on hospice, those became our lodestars along the way. Are we taking away your abilities to do the things you care about? Are we enhancing your abilities to do the things you care about?
Doctors aren't really trained to be like that, though, are they? I mean, is it learning a new skill to be able to, A, listen, and B, listen for those particular aspects of when someone's at the end of their life?
Yeah, we don't. My opening line in the book is that, you know, I learned a lot about a lot of things in medical school, but mortality wasn't one of them. And you don't learn about it on two levels, which is part of what I ended up trying to write about. Number one is, what is the science of how you age and die? You know, what actually happens to your body as you become frail? What are the problems that we currently can't fix, you know, that happen to people? And then second, how do you talk to and develop, how do you talk to people about these problems and develop the skills to make better decisions with folks? I spent a fair amount of time with a geriatrician, for example, and the science of how you lose your balance and why you start to fall at a certain age and what the risk factors are, how certain drugs put you at much higher risk of falling, or how nutrition and your strength play into that. Falling after a certain point in your life becomes the most dangerous thing that can happen to you, and it can sacrifice every bit of your quality of life. There are known things to do to recognize people who are at risk and then to reduce that risk. And we don't learn them. We don't learn them at all.
You write about how it's really important, and particularly in assisted living situations, that someone have some measure of control over their life, even if it means eating candy when they're diabetic. They have to. If they should be allowed to make some mistakes, even at the end of their lives when things are so tenuous.
Yeah. So once you start realizing that, you know, we need to be asking people what their priorities are besides just living longer, you realize that we aren't asking those questions. And not only is it when you're near the end of life, it goes well up the chain, including at those moments when your life starts to be constricted by problems that medicine's not fixing. You know, when you become frail and start needing help to live your regular life. Once you start needing help, it's presumed that you have to give over your choices to medical values. You know, you check into an assisted living facility or a nursing home, and health and safety are the medical priorities, and so they come first. When in fact, people's idea of well-being is bigger than health and safety. And food is a classic great example. There are new places being designed that I visit where instead of being built around a nurse's station, you know, more and more nursing homes look like hospitals. They're built around a nurse's station. They made these so that they're not a long hallway, but instead, you know, circular hallways with just 10 to 12 people in a group, and it surrounds a kitchen, like in your home. And in that kitchen, you can go to the refrigerator, and you can open the door, and you can have whatever you want. And do you know how controversial that is? Because a diabetic might go into the fridge and have a can of soda, or an Alzheimer's patient might not choose to have purely pureed food. The biggest reason you get written up in these places, and by the way, you're living in a place where you can get written up. The biggest reason is because you violated food rules. So, you know, an Alzheimer's patient in their 80s, not eating the pureed diet they're supposed to be on because they're hoarding cookies, like one woman that I caught. And, you know, it's like, let them eat the cookies. And the assumption is that, well, you know, there'll be malpractice lawsuits, it'll be dangerous. But instead, people actually having that feeling like you live in a prison takes away people's sense of purpose, makes them feel bored. They become passive creatures. They don't have anything to live for anymore. And it's as simple as food, but it's as complicated as just because you're in a wheelchair doesn't mean you can't be connected to the church you went to or your friends you used to have or the kinds of ways you used to contribute in the community. And there are places and means of making it happen, and it doesn't cost more. It's more a cultural issue than it is the cost issue.
Atul Gawande is my guest. His most recent book is called Being Mortal. Of course, it's not simply a conversation between the person who's headed toward death and the physicians. It's also the family that's involved. And as you say, oftentimes the family's priorities are simply for safety and security, and that might leave out, they might not see important things that need to be factored in. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I had a chance to meet with a woman named Karen Brown Wilson, who founded the first assisted living facility a little over 20 years ago. And she founded it for her mother, who said, you know, these places are not built for me. Her mother had a stroke at 55, was disabled severely, but her brain was fine. And she's like, you know, my home is a place where I should still be allowed to lock the door, where I'm allowed privacy, where if I want to keep my stack of knickknacks and National Geographics, I can keep them without somebody clearing them out and throwing them away and then having no accountability whatsoever. And she said to me that the interesting thing about these facilities and how they evolved is that they market to the children. It's the children who make the decisions. And she said, safety is what we want for those we love, but autonomy is what we want for ourselves. And when we're looking around at places for parents, with parents, you know, the questions we ask are always around, you know, is it safe? That's what we're most concerned about. Not are people lonely here? How much do people ask and care about what really matters in their life? You know, the activities are very passive. They're very scheduled. You wake up at 7 o'clock when you're supposed to wake up. You wait in the pill line. You get dressed when they tell you to get dressed. You know, what if you just want to sleep in today? You know, what if you want to stay up all night and have a couple friends over to your to your place for, you know, listening to music, having a party? And I describe people living in places that actually can happen.
What are the key questions for family members and loved ones when considering when they're presented with medical recommendations at the end of life? What kind of questions should they be asking the doctors, and if it's assisted living center or a nursing home, what should they be looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, I think it works across the board. So just as I found that these key questions that a doctor should ask people about concerning their priorities applied, I found there's no reason that families can't be doing it as well, and that we want to know from our own family members, you know, what is their understanding of their health and what are their fears and worries and what are their goals if with the time that they have, and what are the outcomes that are unacceptable to them? And we really aren't used to asking them as family members at all. But there is nothing more important to people's sense of their lives, the worth of their lives, than understanding their priorities besides just health. When you ask these questions, then it also gives you the tools to be able to ask that the places that they're part of, that they're doctors, that they're, if it's workers coming into the home or going, you know, when we reach that point in our lives where we need help, that doesn't mean that life ends. And being able to describe what life is for my parent or my grandparent or for myself, we have to get these words to be able to give them to people.
You know, at one point in the book, you're dealing with your father's severe illness, and your mother's a doctor, your father's a doctor, you're a doctor, and you're listening to a professional giving you the options, and the three of you are in the dark.
Yeah. So my father went through he made very clear that as long as he could sustain his surgical practice, he wanted to hold off on these therapies because they were going to sacrifice that for him. And so he waited a couple years until his disease advanced and then underwent surgery. That bought him more time to avoid quadriplegia. But then he took radiation therapy in the hope that it would buy more time, and in fact made things worse. He had many of the bad side effects and none of the benefit. And then they said, well, then we ought to do chemotherapy. And they gave 8-9 different options. And even for 120 years of medical experience among our three family members, we couldn't make heads or tails of connecting those options to what mattered to my father. And so what I had to do, what we all had to do, was we had to say to the oncologist, okay, help me understand. Just stop for a minute. Without treatment, what's the longest you've seen somebody live and what's the shortest? And she said the longest was about 3 years and the shortest was 3 months. And then we said, well, with treatment, how long would you see somebody live? And she said, well, still about 3 years, but it's more likely to be closer to 3 years. Yeah, if he benefit. And then the eight different treatments that were, you know, he said, well, you know, really important to him is that he not be so fatigued he can't get out of bed, or that, you know, he not be so nauseated that he can't do what he needs to do. It was hard to get her to see these are the priorities here. And it was hard for her to compute. And so she just still came down on the side of, well, you should take these chemotherapies here. These will have the least side effects. My dad, sitting on it for a day, decided he wasn't going to do any of the chemotherapy and ended up at that point, that was the moment that he chose to go on hospice. It looked like he would just have a few weeks at the most at that point. It ended up being about 4.5 months, in part because the hospice care shifted the focus. Instead of sacrificing your quality of life now for the sake of time later, it was what do we do to give you the best possible day now? And don't worry about whether that adds more time later. And so, you know, they focused on pain control and assisting him so he had fewer falls. He was having falls almost every few days. And each fall would make him be in bed for 24 hours. He would get that much weaker. He'd fall again. And they really concentrated on, let's get a stretch of 2 weeks without falls. And suddenly this person who was, you know, nearly quadriplegic, barely could walk, could suddenly walk again and have some strength and begin doing a few things along the way and had stopped the medications. And that's the fascinating thing.
It's so complicated because even with your situation with your father, it sounds as though you made some decisions in retrospect that were good decisions and maybe a decision that wasn't a good decision along the way. Even well-informed, you're still taking your chances. Maybe it's not like a lottery ticket, but you're still taking a chance on whether you're making the right decision or not.
Yeah, and I walk through a lot of different both patients I took care of, my father's situation. You know, my father was on hospice, and when he became unresponsive, my mother called 911. And, you know, they resuscitated him, and he woke up in the hospital, and he said, what am I doing here?
Which was exactly what he didn't want. He didn't want to take it. He didn't want to be resuscitated.
Yeah. It wasn't the end of the world, though, because, you know, there are mistakes that happen along the way, and there are conflicts within family around, you know, my mother was still in some denial about where this was going, and my sister was in a midway point between my mother and me who, you know, I was thinking, like, I know where this is going. And she understood from my father, well, when she got to the emergency room, she didn't let them put him on a breathing machine. She didn't let them shock his heart, do all those any of those moves. But with fluids and some oxygen, he recovered. He had some extra time. And from my mom's point of view, that let my sister and I get there. And she saw that as really valuable. For my father, he was in his own hospital. He was a surgeon now, admitted at his own hospital. And his colleagues wouldn't give him the pain medication he needed because they were worried. They'd give him tiny doses because they were worried it would make him unresponsive again. And he checked himself out in less than 24 hours saying, forget it. You know, these people don't understand my priorities. And I'm going home and we're going to follow them. And my mother, you know, had that uncertainty. Would I be doing the wrong thing if I didn't try to bring him back? Now she knew the right thing was what happened over the next 5 days, which is he gradually faded away.
Atul Gawande is my guest, and we're talking about his most recent book called Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. We didn't talk about money at all, but one well-known fact is that a huge amount of money is spent in these end-of-life treatments that generally do not prolong life particularly. We've changed the way we look at funding for healthcare in our country since the Affordable Care Act passed. Is that having any kind of an influence on how end-of-life care takes place?
25% of our spending after age 65 is on the last year of life, and the majority of that is in the last few months. And the benefits are limited, if any, and I think most of the evidence is that that we could do that far better and actually save more time for people, and it'd be better time. The striking thing, and I can't trace it to the Affordable Care Act, but there's many forces at work here. So in 1945, the majority of people died in their home. And the reason they died in their home was they didn't see any point in going to the hospital. There wasn't much a hospital had to offer in 1945. By the end of the 90s, as I mentioned, it actually was 83% died in institutions, because in medical institutions, hospitals, and nursing homes, it was felt that these are the places that would solve your problems. But in the last 5 years, we've begun to really care about what happens with the quality of life that people have. And a striking turnaround is happening. We're now past 45% of the population at death are in hospice, either in the home or in a hospice center outside of hospitals and those kinds of settings. And that's allowing families to be around and connected and fundamental parts of this experience of dying and being connected in important ways that allow people to have that chance to connect to the people we love, to pass along wisdoms, to be at peace with God is an important thing for many people that doctors don't even necessarily understand, but turn up in all of the surveys over and over again. It's a striking change that we're in the midst of right now. Some of it is some of the ways that we pay doctors. Some of it is, I think, the public demands that the quality of life count.
You mentioned that when you were in medical school, you didn't really learn much about this at all. And part of this book is your own process of looking into it more deeply and finding out how end-of-life things were handled by other professionals and how families dealt with it. But has anything changed at medical school? Is any of this new acknowledgement that it's not just about health, it's also about the soul, is that taking hold in medical schools?
Well, on one level, I'd say yes. There is much more time spent in medical schools than I certainly had about how do you break bad news and give people some practice with how do you break bad news, how do you talk about a do not resuscitate order. But I think we have not had the words. We didn't know what the real words are to use. Who's going to teach those capabilities? It hasn't been crisply identified. And so, you know, we're still in a world where 97% of medical students don't have any geriatrics training, for example, and then don't know how to talk to people about priorities and goals and connect that into their care. You know, it's that idea that we're evolving beyond the paternalistic doctor and beyond the retail doctor to someone who really plays a counselor role, and becoming effective at that is more than just a class here or there. It has to be embedded in medical school and then in your training at each step along the way. And even for, you know, well-established physicians, developing those skills is, you know, I've had to learn how to do it. I'm at the midpoint in my career.
And we're looking now at a rapidly aging population in the United States and even more so in other parts of the world. And yet the specialty of geriatrics, which takes a look at people and trying to make them accommodate to the various disabilities that they have, is really not a very popular profession. It seems as though, as you point out, sometimes for doctors, dealing with old people is kind of annoying. They forget the information. They ask questions over and over again. They don't quite track. And it's not a very popular area, even though there's so much need for it.
Well, but I think that's our fault, right? So number one, we are today training and graduating fewer people in geriatrics than we did a decade ago. And we were already training too few people. These are people who are among the lowest paid in the profession of medicine. People who spend time having to deal with complex issues where it might take a 45, 50-minute, hour-long appointment because this person has 6 different medical issues, 10 different drugs, and 5 different specialists. And what's the goal again? And then, you know, it's also true of palliative care doctors. It's true of primary care doctors, that these are people who, you know, I get paid for doing very well, for doing procedures, not for making good decisions with people. So we have to make sure that doctors are actually financially rewarded and enabled to take the time to have these conversations and have them repeatedly and have good decision making. On another level, I think there is a sense that we have to give the make these better remunerated parts of our profession, and that's starting to happen as we have health systems that are held accountable for the quality and cost of their care, because they're suddenly discovering these skills are really important. And then I think there's also just a sense of we have to have an imagination as a society that a good life is possible even if you are frail, even if you're ill and have chronic illness or a terminal illness that's going to take your time, that as a society we have to be willing to recognize that we've had an imagination deficit. And then we want people, both inside the profession and outside the profession, who can help you achieve that goal of, you know, as good a life as possible to the very end. And then, you know, it'll suddenly seem like it's not empty work to people in those fields. We may even be picking the wrong people to come into medicine sometimes.
And what about us? I mean, I thought I knew some things about end-of-life issues. I dealt with my father and cancer. But from reading this book, I realized I didn't know a fraction of what can actually go on at the end of life.
What did you feel like you picked up?
I feel like I picked up the fact that you really need to consider the questions that you need to answer for yourself. Mm. I don't have a living will yet. I realized, of course, that's an obvious thing. And so what's your advice for people who may not realize what's coming at them? What do they really need to think through or start to think through to be prepared themselves?
Well, I think on one level, what's interesting is that I find living wills really almost useless for me as a doctor trying to make decisions when the time comes. It says time comes. They invariably say something along the lines of, you know, as long as my condition is not reversible, I don't want to be on a ventilator and things like that. And that's very helpful. But, you know, many of the decisions are upstream and much more important. And knowing what quality of life means to you, you know, what's important, like, if the best living will I ever heard was that colleague who said that her father said, you know, chocolate ice cream and football on television, and that's good enough for me. My wife and I had this conversation, and we came to completely different concepts about this. For me, if I'm a brain in a jar connected up to some sensory devices that allow me to talk and perceive what's going on in the world, I will be fine. But if I'm a seemingly healthy body, but I'm not a person inside there, I'm not who I am, let me go. My wife says, that's crazy. If I look happy, that is good enough for me. And those are the best living wills I could ever write for somebody. Now I have guidance, whether I'm a doctor or a family member, about what matters. And I think this is really important because 70% of us will come to the end with somebody else needing to make the decisions. That moment is gone if you aren't addressing it up front. It will change. I mean, I know my wife and I, we're probably people who, as we encounter health issues in our future, we may change what our, you know, idea of a good life is. But if we're having that conversation iteratively and letting people know that take care of us, what that content is of a good life, an adequate life.
Yeah.
That is the thing to communicate.
Well, the question we should probably always be asking ourselves, what do I want to get out of my life, and particularly acute at that time when you might be losing a lot of control?
Yeah.
What do you have to say to those who believe we might be on the verge of being able to live to 150 years old and replace our body parts like we do old parts of an automobile and just keep on going? This book, to me, was a big slap in the face to that idea.
Well, there are a couple things. Number one is, look, that's been the dream, you know, since the fountain of youth, and also been the possible terror of the idea that we, going back to Greek mythology of the person who could be granted immortal life but be crumbling and have a life that's not worth living. We can live that fantasy, and in many ways we might discover things that help extend our lives. We've added 30 years to the average human being's life over the last century, and we may well be able to add more, but we now have to be able to think about what is living during that life and how do we make sure that we've extended that last phase of our lives. The very American ideal is that, hey, if I'm not independent, then it must be not worth living. And we just sort of say, well, medicine will take care of it. I think medicine has a very narrow view of life. It's one around being healthy, alive, and safe. But when you can't be healthy, when your life is narrowing, there is this larger idea which we can ask for society to help with, our family to help with, medicine to help with, achieving, you know, just the best possible day under the circumstances. And I think that's the part that's missing from those who might be trying to come up with the immortality drug. Go for the immortality drug. I'll take it. But whatever time I have, I want it to be a life that's worth living.
Atul Gawande, the book is called Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. Thank you so much for stopping by.
And thank you. This is great.
This is The Record on KUOW.